Hello, this is The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley, and when we say intersection, we're talking about the intersection of politics and culture. Glad you're here. Welcome. Thank you so much for listening to my podcast. Segment one is about Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks founder. For those of you who maybe don't know who he is, been living under a rock for the last 7-8 years, he is the founder of WikiLeaks, and he has become an extraordinarily polarizing figure. How polarizing, you might ask? He has defenders, and I mean ardent defenders. And I was in a discussion with a friend of mine who happens to be active, well, not active duty military. He's in the reserves. And he said to me with a perfectly straight face, if they extradite Julian Assange back to the United States, he ought to be tried. If convicted, he should be taken out and shot, because he's a traitor and he cost potentially, because I don't know that he actually cost any American lives, but he said he potentially jeopardized numbers of American lives. Now, he's talking specifically about some of the leaks from WikiLeaks, some of the early leaks back to 2010, when they were exposing government wrongdoing. Of course, since then, and I think this is why Assange has become so polarizing, in those 7 years since, he has exposed other things that people on the left would just as soon he not have exposed. He has been, for people who don't know again, holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy for the past almost 7 years. And last week, he was evicted from that embassy. Those who don't like him say he's essentially a Russian agent. And that's for, again, WikiLeaks' role in the 2016 election, which some people, not all people, but some people feel led to the election of Donald Trump. So which one is Julian Assange? Is he a crusading journalist, as some say, or is he a traitor? It's interesting to see when Julian Assange first went on the lam and wound up just before he went to the Ecuadorian embassy, the Obama administration was making dark threats about charging Assange with espionage. Espionage. Now, espionage under certain circumstances could be a capital offense. The U.S. this time around has not charged him with espionage, only with conspiring along with Chelsea Manning to steal U.S. military secrets. Right now, he's in a British jail facing charges that he failed to surrender to British authorities back in 2012. That was when they were looking for him to attempt to extradite him to Sweden, where he faced sexual assault charges. Those charges have since been dropped. The Swedish government, however, says they may, and this is not a certainty, but they may reopen that investigation into Assange's alleged sexual assault. WikiLeaks dump of material damaging to Hillary Clinton in 2016, and this is just my own judgment, just my own opinion, contributed to her defeat by Donald Trump. That doesn't mean it alone caused it, but I think taken with other things, it did in fact contribute to Hillary Clinton's loss to Donald Trump. I say this because I was out canvassing in Philadelphia in 2016 as part of my work and came across numbers of people of color, younger people, several people of whom were renovating buildings in West Philadelphia. And they said to me, you know, I really can't stand Donald Trump. And this was, you know, almost, I'm paraphrasing, but this was on the lips of many people. So I don't like Donald Trump, but I don't trust Hillary Clinton. I don't trust her. Therefore, I'm not going to vote for her. I'll sit this out. And try as I might to convince them to vote for Hillary, they gave me lip service, but I could tell by the look on their faces they were not going to go in and pull that lever for Hillary Clinton. Now, I talked to a few people that were like that, and I believe that that lack of trust was a byproduct of WikiLeaks dumping those emails that were disparaging not just to Hillary Clinton, but to her staff as well. One of the things I find fascinating about this entire situation is if you go back to 2016, as some people have already done, by the way, and listened to Donald Trump talk about WikiLeaks. He was like, hooray for WikiLeaks, hooray for WikiLeaks. They're wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. The other day, somebody asked him about WikiLeaks, and he said, and I'm paraphrasing here, I don't really know anything about WikiLeaks. I have no history with WikiLeaks, which is more a reflection of Donald Trump than anything else. Certainly, perhaps as much on WikiLeaks, but certainly on Donald Trump and how he will drop anything like third period French if it doesn't suit his purpose. Now, there are questions, and by the way, the Ecuadorians have brought this up, questions about Assange's, oh God, do I repeat myself, questionable conduct during that 6+ years he lived in the Ecuadorian embassy. They said his personal hygiene was sorely lacking. I'm not going to get into on what level. They said his cat was out of control. And he took to berating and confronting embassy staff. Now, the embassy, the Ecuadorian embassy in Britain, in England, is a small place. I mean, it's not like it's gigantic or anything. It's not like it's Buckingham Palace. And Assange had a pitifully small room inside that embassy. And perhaps after 6.5 years, people might tend to get a little whack. But personal hygiene, that's just like, yo, what? And more than one person commented very negatively about that. Now, Julian Assange's personal hygiene has absolutely nothing to do with the charges, whether it be in Britain, whether it be in the United States, whether it be in Sweden, nothing to do with those charges. But what it did do was tend to tarnish his image, at least to some small extent. Now, the president of Ecuador accuses Assange of using the embassy as a center for spying. Now, this has to do with some WikiLeaks dumps about the president's brother, I believe it is, somebody in his family. And the Ecuadorians, as somebody who has offered this man asylum when very few other countries would, and who extended a hand of friendship to the man, to the point, by the way, where the guy who originally made the offer, Correa, is no longer president. And now the guy turns around and acts like, I guess it might be called biting the hand that feeds you. I don't know if Julian Assange used that embassy as a center for spying. He'd be foolish to do so, but, you know, dropping an email dump about the family of your host would at very least seem biting the hand that feeds you. Now, as I mentioned, Assange has had and will maintain, I believe, some level of support from some pretty high-profile people. Glenn Greenwald, the publisher of The Intercept, has been one of Assange's staunchest defenders. Now, Greenwald himself has been pilloried for his support of Assange and for his downplaying the role of Russians in, or Russia, in the 2016 election. Glenn Greenwald doesn't believe any of that hype. John Oliver, on the other hand, host of Last Week Tonight, and one of my favorite people on television, says, listen, I'm not that big a fan of Julian Assange as a person. However, there are some journalistic principles here. See, because what they accused Assange of doing is something that, with a little tweaking, journalists do all the time. I would refer those of you who are old enough to remember to the Pentagon Papers. And that was before, by the way, we had computers and cyber this and social that. But in this case, we're talking about the possibility or even the likelihood that there was I don't want to say, because it's not espionage. It really is. Otherwise, they'd have charged him with it. But they, Manning and Assange, got together and figured out, apparently, a password, which is the center of the charge against Assange, that he conspired with Manning to acquire a password to access government secrets. Now, John Oliver and others who were concerned with the journalistic aspect of this are very, very nervous that what they're charging him with is something that they could, in theory, in the future, somewhere down the road, charge a journalist with if they exposed secrets that the government did not want exposed. It could tighten that net. It could tighten that noose around the necks of journalists. And as you well know, Trump's base, I don't want to say hates journalists, but they certainly don't trust them, most of them. You know, the MSM, mainstream media, they don't trust journalists. So as far as they're concerned, journalists have no right to go after information that the government wants kept secret, whether it's classified or not classified. So it's a slippery slope, and this is just my judgment. It is a slippery slope because it might be one that would allow the government in this day and age to go after journalists who are seeking the truth. Not a whole heck of a lot, the truth. At the end of the day, I guess you could applaud Julian Assange and WikiLeaks for their early work back in 2010, while at the same time decrying their influence in the 2016 election. Now, you know, WikiLeaks created they released email dumps on a bunch of different people. And this is the danger with a polarized ideology. Because what ends up happening is people on the one hand who are progressive, left, liberal, or whatever, they'll agree with that part of WikiLeaks or the emails that WikiLeaks dumps that reinforces their view of the world. That the government's secretive, that the government's doing this, that, and the other that they shouldn't be doing. You know the drill. On the other hand, other people will sit up and say that while those email dumps are borderline traitorous, those on Hillary Clinton saved the country from her presidency. And on that level, you have to wonder, are we that locked in? Are we that polarized around our own positions, philosophies, ideologies? And Julian Assange, hate to say it, is a prima facie case as to why that does not always work. Can anything short of locking him up stop him from doing what he does? I kind of don't think so. I think if this guy is still free, he will continue through WikiLeaks, obviously he started it, to do these email dumps. When he can get access to it, when he can find it, when whatever methodology he uses works for him. And by the way, when they took him out of that the Ecuadorian embassy, when I first saw him, I thought to myself, this is Photoshopped, because it looked as though it was Julian Assange's head with a beard and a bun in the back, but it didn't look like his body. He was resisting, by the way, saying the British had no right to pull him out of the embassy and lock him up, and that the Ecuadorians had no right to boot him. I don't know how he could say that. After all, it is their embassy. I don't know whether people who applaud Julian Assange would want to live with him for almost 7 years. I'm not sure that's true at all. You know, now, if they bounced him because, you know, he had bad personal hygiene or he was skateboarding up and down the halls or his cat was making messes and he was smearing feces on the wall, I don't know and I don't care. What's important here is whether or not WikiLeaks has any veracity going forward, whether WikiLeaks becomes either a pariah or a savior to people, because I'm not really concerned about what conservatives think of it, but certainly I do have a concern about what progressives think of it. And I know that people have, for example, dumped all over Glenn Greenwald, you know, for being, among other things, too sympathetic to Assange, and some even call him a Russian agent. I think that's nonsense. But the flip side is, Which way are you going to go on Julian Assange? I'd be curious to hear from you who you think is right in this. Is Assange a crusading journalist or is Assange a traitor? Send me an email to mark@markreillymedia.com. Let your voice be heard. I'm curious what you think. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about sanctuary cities.
You say it's the worst that we didn't speak. But it's mostly the worst that you didn't keep. The mistakes being me, I didn't see. All of the smoke and the mirrors being reflected off of me. Somebody should have told me.
Welcome back. The Intersection, the intersection of politics and culture. I'm Mark Reilly. Thank you again so much for listening. Sanctuary cities. You know that the Trump administration hates them and hates the idea of sanctuary cities. So how does he get even? He now says he's got a plan to send detained undocumented immigrants to sanctuary cities across the country. Now, as is the case with an awful lot that comes out of both Donald Trump's mouth and the White House, first is yes, we're doing it, then no, we probably won't do it, and then yes, we'll do it again. You know, the ultimate irony here is that Trump and his enablers in the White House, like Stephen Miller, say they're doing this as an olive branch to Democrats to get them to see things their way on immigration. Now, I did a little research, and I was utterly stunned at the number of sanctuary cities and counties there are across America. First of all, there are 8 states that are sanctuary states. And then when you count up the cities, it's like 70 some odd. And by the way, this is not from some left-leaning communistic source. This is from a source that really doesn't care that much for immigration. So I imagine they're probably close to factual. So here's the thing about hearing this sanctuary cities business coming out of Trump, who, by the way, was born and raised in New York City. This is what I find almost absurd, almost Alice in Wonderland, through the looking glass kind of stuff. I live close to the greatest city in the world. In my judgment, that would be New York City. At this juncture in its history, New York City has 37% of all of its residents were born outside the United States. That's almost one out of every three, yeah, more than one out of every three people. 37%. That translates to a massive 3 million people. The largest immigrant population in any city on earth. Now, does the Trump administration seriously think sending undocumented immigrants to New York will rip the fabric of this city to shreds? He's got to be kidding. And more importantly, he's from New York. He ought to know better. I mean, I observe a lot when I walk around New York City. A lot. You know, there's certain places I go where there are people who sell newspapers or sell donuts or sell this or sell that. And you look and you talk to people and you can tell. You know, you have women, for example, that work in certain places in the Port Authority bus terminal in New York City. They're wearing hijabs. That would make me think they're probably Muslims. Maybe not, but that would be my educated guess. And you see other people in other stores, delis, etc. You see Arabs. And the Arabs don't just work in the delis. In many cases, they own the delis. Then you have Asian people, Chinese, Korean, who work in other places, other similar situations. You see people that run sandwich shops like Subway. And you see the people that are working behind the counter are all South Asian. This is New York City. You don't come to expect, at least I don't, anything less from this city. You see some of those old pictures, even in the Godfather movie, when Vito Corleone was first coming to the United States. What, he was on a boat, and what do? They run it past the Statue of Liberty. Because for some people who came to America years ago, it was a symbol of freedom, and they were more or less welcome. That doesn't mean, you know, they came in without a hitch. Italians, in particular, were vilified by the upper class in New York City. There were people that didn't even want to breathe the same air as Italians. Of course, that's all changed over time, as well it should. But you see, the immigrants that came in then are not viewed, at least in Washington, at least by this president and his, I don't know whether I should call him an enabler, fool, knave, or whatever, Stephen Miller, who, by the way, doesn't just want to curb what they call illegal immigration. He wants to curb legal immigration to this country. I guess for him, 3 million people in New York City being foreign born is just too many. I don't know what he thinks the ideal number is, but he doesn't live here, so I don't know why he is in the least bit concerned, but he apparently is, and he's not alone. Trump's base, which, by the way, has become one of the most overused and, in my judgment, misunderstood parts of his presidency. Donald Trump's base. How will his base react? We know that Trump's base detests immigration. That we know that for him, it's like throwing up a red flag in front of a bull. He will say that people coming from the southern border are terrorists, gang members, et cetera, offer little or no proof, and ignore completely, and I do mean completely, the fact that the immigrant crime rate in this country is lower than the native-born crime rate. That's right. You may not believe me. Look it up. It's true. But be that as it may, when you live in a New York, when you live in a San Francisco, which is also a sanctuary city, Los Angeles, another sanctuary city, all these places, and you have people who are generally friendly to immigrants. I had an argument with somebody on the radio back in the day who stood me down that he could tell a legal immigrant from an illegal immigrant. And I said, well, how do you do that? Enlighten me, because I had no clue. I can just tell. No, you can't just tell. Explain to me how you tell. I just know. I can look at him and tell. No, that's not justifiable. You're not the immigration police. You're not ICE. You know, and by the way, and this is something that I find amazing and irritating and potentially a gross violation of rights. There are places in this country, because I saw a video of this, I was absolutely stunned. A woman in California apparently was driving through New Mexico or something and came up on a border patrol checkpoint. And they stopped her and they asked her whether or not she was a citizen. And she said, I'm not telling you whether or not I'm a citizen. It's not your business. I'm just passing through. I'm on my way home from wherever it was she was. And she said, I have not been outside the country. Why are you stopping me? And, you know, the immigration guy is arguing with her, then calls in a supervisor who argues with her. It was, in my judgment, a profile in courage, to be brutally honest about it. But truth be told, there are few, if any, ironclad ways of looking at a person who may be an immigrant, and of course, again, you're talking about 3 million people in New York City alone, and determining whether they're legal or not. You can't tell. Not in this city. But yet there are people who think that they can tell just by looking. And one of the things that you get from walking around New York, and I think this is true of San Francisco and other places, There are 180 languages spoken in New York City. 180. And people walk around. They converse with people who they know or who they know are fluent in a particular language in that language. And this whole notion that you're going to ship detainees off to a sanctuary city falls flat on its face. Question number one, once you bring them to a sanctuary city, you're just going to turn them loose? Because if they were not planning on going to that sanctuary city, let's say for the sake of argument, they planned on going to Colorado and you sent them to San Francisco. Do you seriously think that they will stay in San Francisco if, for example, they have family in Colorado, or if, for example, they think they can find a job in Colorado? They will move around. And I don't know how the federal government, who would be responsible for scattering these people all over the place in the first place, I don't know how the federal government's going to keep track of it. We can't even keep track of people who've overstayed their visas. Although, at long last, the Trump administration is talking about doing something about that problem, which is, by the way, a big problem. But how do you corral all these people? You can't force sanctuary cities to set up detention camps to put them in. That would be far, far too militaristic to ask these cities to do, or even to demand that these cities do. And Donald Trump knows this. So when you see, I was going to say something real stupid about this woman, but her name is Sarah Huckabee Sanders. When you see her, that option is not off the table. It's on the table. Yeah? And what, are you going to spread them out all over the country? And for whatever sets of reasons, Donald Trump believes that by sending detained, undocumented immigrants to these sanctuary cities, that the cities themselves, the people in the cities, will rise up and want to do something about immigration. What are you, out of your freaking mind? Are you daft? I mean, it's bad enough you don't even know where your own father was born. Said the other day it was Germany. Turned out it was Queens. So, you know, there is that. But leaving that aside for the moment, how do you plan on forcing sanctuary cities to even keep track of the people you're sending? And don't think for a minute that sanctuary cities are going to set up detention camps or anything like that to keep these people detained. What Donald Trump is in essence admitting is that the federal government seems to have no ability to hold these people in humane conditions with intact families. So let's dump the problem on somebody else. You know, we were separating people. People don't like separation, family separation. We'll send them to a sanctuary city. That is as dumb as it gets. It is stupid, for God's sake. But, you know, if Trump believes that there are so many terrorists crossing the border, the southern border from Mexico, why would he send them to places where the federal government can't keep track of them anymore? This is, in my humble judgment, another Donald Trump whack-a-mole. What do I mean? Y'all know that carnival game where you have a soft hammer in your hand and these things pop up and you try and hit them before they go back down? That's whack-a-mole. And Donald Trump is playing a tremendous game of whack-a-mole with the American people. One thing pops up, you try to hit it, he pops down again. He says, I'm going to do this, that, and the other. 2 minutes later, nah, not going to do it. Or his people, even more embarrassing, back him up on something he says he's going to do, and suddenly he undercuts them, pulls the rug right out from underneath them by saying, no, I'm not doing that. I'm doing something different. This is the man that has been elected president of the United States. And God help me, I didn't want to talk about him, but this sanctuary city thing is just too much. And I say to Donald Trump, yo, you want to send people to sanctuary cities? Assuming you can vet them, which you can't, send them. We'll make them Americans. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast, to The Intersection. You can like my Facebook page at Mark Riley Media, and don't forget to comment, because your opinions are important to me. When we come back, our final segment, measles.
Broadcasting from New York City, podcasting to the world, you're listening to The Intersection of Politics and Culture with Mark Riley.
We're back. This is The Intersection. Thank you so much for listening. Whether you agree or disagree with me, let's have that conversation. Post your comments on my Facebook page at Mark Riley Media. Final segment, measles. Now, I'm sure for most people, measles kind of makes you nostalgic for the old days, childhood. I mean, not nostalgic, because measles is an awful thing to get. But, you know, you got vaccinated and, in theory, you inoculated yourself against measles or the spread of measles. So it comes as a surprise to me personally that there is so much controversy around whether or not to vaccinate children against childhood diseases, specifically measles. When I was a kid, I thought everybody that went to school had vaccinations against these common childhood diseases. In fact, the Centers for Disease Control, I believe this was in the year 2000, announced that measles had all but been eradicated. Now, however, it appears that measles is making a comeback. And officials believe it's because there are numbers of parents who will not let their children be immunized. Now, there is one thing to say about this. Although the majority of measles cases are children, adults are also getting measles. There are almost 300 documented cases of measles in New York City alone. Now, in a city of 8.5 million people, you sit there and say, well, that's not really that many. Here's the problem. That 300 is way over half of the 465 cases that have been documented nationally in 2019, this year. What happens here is there are two separate sets of rights that collide. Parents, because they usually have the right to decide the fates of their children until they're adults, feel they have the right not just to control their own bodies, but the bodies of their children. In New York's case, the measles outbreak has centered on the Orthodox Jewish community in the borough of Brooklyn. The city's mayor, Bill de Blasio, has declared a public health emergency and ordered mandatory vaccinations in parts of Brooklyn where the outbreak has been severe. I believe it's like four or five different zip codes or census tracts. Now, there has been a great deal of pushback from the Orthodox Jewish community to the point, I believe, that they have filed suit against the mayor's order, which tells you the depth of passion. What I find ironic is I have seen in more than one publication the idea that this is not a religion-based prohibition against getting vaccinated. It's just that the Orthodox Jewish community doesn't believe their kids should be vaccinated. Now, the mayor is saying, on the other hand, that it is absolutely necessary to protect the public health. So that brings up the question, who is right here? Whose rights are paramount? Before you make a decision, think about this for a minute. The African nation of Madagascar has seen 1,200 people die, not just contract measles, die in a measles outbreak there. The problem in Madagascar is not that they don't want their kids vaccinated. It's that parents lack the means or the ability to get their children to centers where they can be vaccinated. Now, in that case, it would seem that the public good outweighs parental rights, at least in that case. Now, here's the problem, and I've heard a great deal of vitriol on both sides of this argument. There are reasonable people, even scientific people, doctors, etc., who will argue that the vaccine that they use to treat measles or to prevent measles creates other problems. Some of you may have heard some people argue that this measles vaccine, in fact, leads to autism in children. And they say they've got the scientific facts to back that up. I don't know whether that's true or not. Sometimes I get a sense that if there's an increase in autism cases and people have a problem with the vaccinations, they just link the two and say, see, this is the problem. These kids should not be vaccinated. And again, there are some very prominent people who have a real problem with vaccines and vaccination. I've heard people on the radio say they have scientific proof that vaccinations and vaccines only cause the disease. And when it comes to explaining what's going on in Williamsburg, in Brooklyn, they say, well, the people who are vaccinated are transmitting it to those who aren't, which would seem to be some pretzel logic if I ever heard it, but they say they got the scientific facts to back it up. And it can get, how best to put this, butt ugly. I understand that there are parents and advocates who are leery of certain vaccines. I am not a doctor, not even close. So I can't comment on the link that some anti-vaccine people assert exists between vaccines and autism. I have no idea. I don't know what causes autism. I'm not sure the people who say it's the vaccines know exactly what causes autism. But I will say this. And I'm talking about the anti-vaccine people, and there's some prominent people, including a couple of prominent people that I know personally, and they are as passionate about this as the people who want to see everyone vaccinated. Now, this latest outbreak would tend to weigh in on the side of people who want everybody to be vaccinated. I saw a story that said in some communities in the Orthodox Jewish community, the vaccination rate is as low as 58%. And in order to really guard against measles outbreaks, you got to have 90 to 98% of the people vaccinated. So I don't know. Are the people who are anti-vaccine risking a wholesale measles outbreak? It's not going to get as bad as Madagascar, that's for sure. There are exemptions to mandatory vaccination. For example, if a child or an adult has a medical condition that makes vaccination for measles dangerous, then they don't have to have it. There are certain religious exemptions. However, I could be wrong. Maybe the Orthodox Jewish community does have some religious stricture against this, but I read that it's not religious. It's just a matter of practice. There are also people, and by the way, you know, when in an environment where you have people that distrust just about everything, including the media and this and that, there are people who distrust the government. And since the whole vaccination protocol comes from the government through the Centers for Disease Control, I mean, they don't necessarily, you know, you don't have people with CDC on their arms vaccinating kids. But still, the protocols come from the CDC. So that being a government agency, there are people who simply do not trust that this government agency is about the business of doing the right thing. I am, in my heart of hearts, a pretty open-minded person, at least about most things. And I can see both sides of this argument, as whack as that may sound to you. But I wonder which one really should take precedence. And in my heart of hearts, I would say, err on the side of vaccinating. Because there hasn't been a problem with kids in particular getting the measles vaccination, and suddenly, and there's a story I saw that said that this whole outbreak started from a kid who went to Israel, unvaccinated, brought the disease back, and it has spread from there? Well, if that's the case, then maybe we ought to be talking about some form of mandatory vaccination. There are laws going back to the beginning of the 20th century and vaccines against smallpox where people didn't want them either. People didn't want to take a needle for smallpox. As virulent and ugly and deadly as smallpox was back then, there were people who wanted nothing to do with vaccines. And measles, for most of us, was, at least in my time, I won't say a momentary irritation because that trivializes it. But it was something you got and you lived through it and you kept on stepping. There was measles and chickenpox. Those were the two that people most feared in children. Now, this back and forth between government and certain segments of the population is, to me, metaphor for something different. I mentioned it earlier. There is a fundamental distrust in some quarters of government, of things that government makes you do, the whole Obama's coming to get my guns thing. This is a distrust of government. Now, you might want to ask yourself, what has government done to earn this level of distrust? I would say, if there were large documented numbers of children who took the measles vaccine and later turned up with autism, I'd be the first one to say, hey, you know what? There's a problem here. But I don't know that that's the case. I hear people say it. Oh, yeah. Well, vaccinated people get autism at a much higher rate than unvaccinated people. Okay, well, I'd love to see the science on that. There are people who will cite you chapter and verse, and I'm sure they're not lying, and I'm sure they're not being disingenuous in their belief systems. I just want to see it. I want to see it because I think it's important. I think it is critically important that we come to a consensus, and not just because this is centered in New York City. It's happening all over the country, by the way, which will show you how fast measles will spread. But it is happening all over the country. And there are people, despite the fact that measles is spreading, they will argue against having their kids or any kids they know subject to the measles vaccine. Show me the science that says it works. Show me the science that says it does not cause autism. And those are legitimate concerns. I'm not trying to trivialize them. But I think in this instance, since almost 20 years ago, the Center for Disease Control said measles is done. There is no problem anymore. And now we see there is. Maybe we need to apply some science as to why it suddenly turned up again. You know, because I'm not, one thing I am skeptical about. I remember when people tried to trace the origin of the HIV virus and traced to some guy who had sex with a guy in Haiti and blah, 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 blah. And that turned out to be crap. So I say that because it's entirely possible that this whole thing about a kid going to Israel might also be crap. I don't know. But I do know that the public's health is important, is critical, and we should not ignore the spread of disease. I don't care what disease it is. We should not ignore it. We should not allow it to continue or to fester. I want to thank you again so much for tuning into my podcast. The 2020 elections are around the corner, like next year. What issues are going to be important to you and your candidate? Send me an email, mark@markreillymedia.com. The executive producer of The Intersection is Ms. Kim Jack Riley. Till we meet again, please be well.